The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. Taping this at a really weird hour. It's like 6:30 here on the West Coast, and my guest just did the Jay Leno show. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, the Clippers across the street have traded for Chris Paul. It's crazy here at LA Live, but in the studio right now, Louis C.K., how are you?
Good. How are you?
It's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Quite a year
for
you.
Do a lot of people listen to this, or do they watch it a lot? What's the most often way that they take
listen.
It in?
Yeah, we're going to slice a couple of clips from this for the interwebs.
Okay.
Which you have thrown yourself into.
Yes.
With this comedy special.
Yep.
Now, it's pretty interesting. It seems like you really wanted to cut out the middleman and create this website, $5, PayPal, stream it. You wrote a thing about please don't torrent this or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't understand that whole world either.
I don't get it. I don't know what
made you. What made you say, I need to cut out the middleman for this?
Well, I didn't want to cut out the middleman. I just didn't need one.
Okay.
You know, I mean, like, that, to me, cutting one out would be a workaround something you're used to needing.
Right.
But there wasn't any reason to have somebody there. I just thought, you know, make this thing and put it up. I've put things on the internet before, on YouTube and stuff. Once in a while, I put clips on YouTube.
Yeah.
And people watch them. They go viral and stuff. And so I was getting ready to do this special, and it's mine. I mean, I didn't ask for somebody's permission to do it. I just rented the theater, you know. I got the booking at the Beacon.
You paid for everything yourself?
Yeah, I paid for it all. And also, I produce a TV show with no help from anybody. So I just use my company and my employees, and we just, let's get six cameras and shoot the show. I've done it before. I did a special that I made myself a couple of years ago called Hilarious.
Yep.
And the big idea there was to make it a movie that you go to see in a theater, like old concert films. And so that was something I tried, and it did okay. And then this time I thought...
But when you tried it, you weren't as... You've gone up a notch in terms of notoriety, I would say.
Yeah,
right?
Since I made that, definitely. Yeah, the series has really given me a lot. This is the first special I've done since I've had the series.
Yeah.
And so I thought, And also, people don't really see... There's not a good model for stand-up specials right now. There's not a thing like when George Carlin would do an HBO special and it was a big deal. They're on sometimes and nobody really watches them. Nothing draws people to the specials. So I
remember,
thought, maybe if I put it somewhere unusual, somewhere that people... I actually originally offered it to an online company and said, you can have this, but I don't want you to give it to anybody else. Like, online is always a dumping ground for stuff that's been on TV or in the movies, and the last place you can see it is online. And I thought it would be kind of cool to say this is whatever, this special. This is a special. It's ghost. You can only see it in this one place. There's not much exclusivity anymore, you know?
Yeah.
Everything's on everything. So I thought, what if it was only one place? And they didn't quite get it. So I said, why aren't I doing this? I just do it and charge $5, which is so close to stealing that it's easy to be honest. And then once I did it, every decision I made me more interested in it. Like, what is the site like? You know, what's it like to buy it? What do you have to do to get it?
How do you get enough bandwidth to carry all the streaming at the same time?
Yeah, we got a huge website. Like, the first thing I thought is, if it crashes, it's a waste of time. So get a huge website, make it really easy. I wrote all the things that are set on all the buttons and everything. I just made it very personal.
Yeah.
And I told them, I don't want it to be that you pay and then you get an email later and then you feel like you lost the thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you pay for it and then all of a sudden you're gone.
Yeah.
And someday you get an email that says you have to do this. You mustn't use this video here. You can't watch it on your Xbox or what, all this kind of crazy stuff. So this one is just a simple video. There's no encryption on it.
I like how you charge $5 instead of $4.99.
Yeah, $4.99 is just a lie. It's just unfair. Don't be a dick. Just
everything about it was very upfront. Like, even that little letter you wrote on the site, like, hey, people who steal things evilly. Please don't do it. I know you're probably going to.
Exactly. Well, if you live in a rough neighborhood and your lock is broken on your door, you know, you kind of want to look at the people that are hanging out on the sidewalk and just go, do me a favor, just leave me alone. I'm going out to get something to eat.
I know I have a nice TV. Don't go in and steal.
Yeah. Just don't go in there. And people will be like, oh, okay. I'm sorry. I was actually thinking of doing it.
Did it work?
Yeah, it really did. I mean, the thing is selling like crazy. So even if people are stealing it, they're not stealing it enough. It's not like they can actually steal it and then someone goes and it's not there.
Yeah.
Also, people have posted it on torrents, but not many people are taking it. That's where it becomes a problem, is when people are taking it instead of buying it.
Well, you mentioned about how, you know, comedy specials, and it's a weird time for that. And I remember when Chris Rock, his 96 special.
Yeah.
That was the first special that I remember in a while that it was like, it became like a water cut. Like, did you see it? Have you seen it? It's on HBO on Saturday night. Remember that?
Yes.
But there was a dry spell there for I don't know how many years. And then that became, then there was Resurgence, and then Comedy Central. Everybody gets a comedy special. They're churning them out.
Yes.
So where are we going with this over the next decade?
It's always that way. It's always going to be cyclical. And also, good comedians are like cicadas, kind of. Like, that's like a good, but it's like a 25-year cycle. That's how long it takes.
Yeah.
It takes 25 years to make a great comic. So there's gaps. There's times where there's not really anybody around.
So you think there's like a cluster theory?
I think so. And
that's
a generation that sort of, and also Chris spawned some great comedians. He inspired me to do it the way I do it. You know, he inspired me to think about specials as like a masterpiece of work, you know, a great work. So, and actually seeing his made me go back, and I'd seen them before, but it made me go back and look at like Pryor Live in Concert and Bill Cosby himself and all of George Carlin's, and really go, these are really important. This is like, if I could do this really great, that'd be something, you know?
Yeah.
So every time somebody succeeds at it, then there's a bunch of good ones. And then there's a lot of, it degenerates, you know, it's like, and then it dilutes, you get a bunch of bad ones. People get turned off to it, and then they stop watching.
The cluster thing's interesting, because I remember like watching Letterman in the early 80s, and it was that whole group, and you could see it, and it was Seinfeld and Leno and Bill Maher and Stephen Wright and all these people, and they were all at the same time.
Yeah.
And then that group kind of graduated and became famous.
That's right.
So who was in your group?
Well, me and I started in Boston, and there was a bunch of guys who came out of Boston during that era. Me and David Cross were roommates, and then he went on and did all this crazy stuff. And Nick DiPaolo and I were roommates. And Joe Rogan, I knew Joe Rogan when he started in Boston. He was a little after me, you know, young comic, now Joe Rogan.
Yeah.
A bunch of people. Dave Attell.
David Tell, when he had hair. You were in the 1995 Young Comedian special.
That's right.
HBO will run those back every once in a while.
Yeah, they will. It's me, David Tell.
Somebody else was really good in that, too.
Anthony Clark was in it. Dave Chappelle.
That's what it was.
That was a power lineup.
Yeah, really
a guy
was.
Named Eric Tunney, who died recently, unfortunately. But there was a pretty... I had to close that show. I remember that well.
It was just on. It was on like 2 weeks ago, and I ended up watching it because it... I'm always fascinated when they had those.
I'll never forget.
Gary Shanley. And he was like, you know, he was like really into it because it was like a big deal at the time.
Yeah, it was live. They did it live.
I remember the Kinison one. I remember watching live as a kid and just not even knowing what to do with myself.
That was a great generation.
Yeah.
And
that was
him
good.
And Dice and all these guys.
So what about like YouTube clips, Twitter?
Yeah.
Is this stuff helping comedy or hurting it, in your opinion?
Well, it's the same. It's the trappings are always different, but everything's the same. There's still only a certain percentage of people that are good at anything.
Yeah.
And so when it was just TV and clubs, then you had some clubs and some TV shows that had bad comics, and mostly bad, and then a few good ones.
Mm-hmm.
Most people are bad at everything, so most people aren't amazing. It would be a weird world if they were.
Right.
So now there's a lot of bad comics with Twitter and YouTube videos, and then there's some good ones. It's just that's the way people are seeing stuff now.
Do you think it's forced people to, I mean, you would probably have done this anyway, but you can't really crest on an hour of material for 5 years anymore, whereas I would say in the late 80s, you probably could have gone on the TV shows, done your little 5-minute things, and then done the same act around the country, and nobody would have really known.
Yeah, people did repeat stuff more in the past, I think. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what it's like for guys that are coming up now and struggling or, you know, or making their way now. It's so different now because... I mean, I came right after an era ended. That used to be that if you went on The Tonight Show or Letterman, as soon as you went on the show and got 2 laughs, you were a millionaire. It was just crazy.
Yeah.
You just, I remember I worked for Dana Carvey, and I did. I was doing stand-up and then writing for Dana Carvey during the day. And I ran off one day to do Letterman. Like, I ran, like, I was like, I'll be right back. And I went and did Letterman. And I had a great set. It was my second time on the show. And Dana watched the set with me. We were pals. And he said, if you had had that set on Letterman, like, 5 years ago, you'd be a huge, like, you walk, everywhere you walk, you get a standing ovation. You'd just be, you'd get all these, just checks would come in the mail. And now it's right after, I came right after that, and I had a bunch of good sets on Tonight Show, Letterman, Conan. Doesn't mean anything. People weren't looking there to see who's next, and it didn't matter anymore.
You seem like, you know, with your career, it seemed like you were at this point as recently as 2 years ago where you were the comedian that the other comedians mentioned. They're like, who's the best comic record?
Yeah.
There? And they'd say you.
Mm-hmm. That's good. That's nice.
And you'd done 2 TV things that hadn't worked out the way you wanted to. Mm-hmm. What made you want to do TV the third time?
Well, I never keep trying one. Like, stand-up is always the standby for me. Like, that's what I do.
The meal ticket.
That's what I am. I'm a comic. I'm a comedian. So anything else I do, it's like if I make a movie, I would never say I'm a filmmaker. I would never call myself that. I'm a comedian who made a movie, you know.
Right.
I'm definitely a comedian.
Yeah.
I can say that one thing with confidence. But so I've tried TV, and I try it, and it doesn't work, and then I go back to comedy. And then if something I'm doing as a stand-up leads me back to, like, hey, this might be a show, then I'll try. I'll try anything that I think might be good. I don't care about, like, well, I failed at it before. You know what I mean? Who cares? Try it again. I mean, there's always
I love that philosophy.
Well, also, well, the first time I did a pilot, the very first time I got a deal to do a pilot for a sitcom, I wrote it, and they really liked it, and it got close, and then they said, we're not going to make the pilot.
That was St. Louis?
No, that was before that. It was a whole other thing. And then I wrote St. Louis with this other guy, and they made the pilot. We got to shoot a pilot. It was so exciting. And I shot a pilot. And then they said, we're not going to make the show. All right. Third time around, made a pilot and got 1 season of Lucky Louie on the air. And then that's all they wanted. There's a limit to everything that you can't think everything's just going to be everything forever.
Yeah.
That was the limit of that one. I did 1 season. Okay. And now I've done Louie, and I've gone 3 seasons. So I'm got a little further each time. I push the ball a little further ahead each time. I mean, not doing something because it didn't work would be like if you're a quarterback and you go to the line of scrimmage at the 25 or wherever the guy ran it to, and you hand the ball off, and the guy pushes it 8 yards, and you're like, well, we didn't score a touchdown, so I'll go home.
Right.
I mean, there's no point.
But at the same time, you had a choice, right? With you could have done the FX thing, but you were also talking about doing a traditional network sitcom, right?
Yeah, when I got the FX show, I didn't need a TV show. I really didn't care if I did one or not because I was having such a good time on the road and I was making a ton of money on the road. I mean, for me. And I was happy. And so people are asking me if I wanted to do a TV show. So my thought was, the only reason I'll do a TV show is if they just throw so much money at me that I could maybe stay home for a while, be a better father, you know. So, you know, the way that TV shows work is they pay you an enormous amount of money to try to make a TV show. And you get that money even if the show doesn't. You're actually incentivized to fail.
And they give you terrible notes.
Yeah, and they tell you this show makes no sense and this thing. And you go, oh, okay. And then you just sort of pretend to rewrite it. And then they go, no, we're not going to do it. And you go, oh, that's all right. Then you take your money and you go on to something else. It's so dumb.
Yeah.
It's a bad system. I was totally down for it because I got kids. And I'm always anxious about not having enough money and going broke and stuff because I was raised poor. But so FX came and said, do a show. It can be anything you want. And I said, how much? And they said $200,000 an episode. And I said, there's no way I'm way I'm doing that. I was like, so that's what you pay for the episode. What do I get paid? They're like, you get whatever you can out of that and the production. And I said, the only way I'm doing it is if you can't, you don't even know what the show's about. I'm not going to show you the script. You just give me that money. Give me $200,000. in a bank wire, and I will give you a DVD of a show.
They wired it to you?
Yeah, like literally, I set up a company and they wired the money. That was it.
And I didn't even know
what the show was about. I decided I don't even want to think about what the show's about until the money's in the bank. And then once I had a company and I hired a producer I'd worked with before in New York, and we got the money, and then I started writing and thinking of stuff to shoot. And I didn't write the whole thing. Usually you have to write the whole thing, and they read it, and they give you notes, and then you rewrite it with their ideas until they like it. But this way, like, I wrote one scene without knowing who was going to be in the show or what it's about. I just wrote one scene and shot it. And then by the time I got to the set for that scene, I was writing other stuff, just writing it with pen and paper sometimes, and just wrote and shot and invented the show with a crew, like, while I was shooting.
Isn't that how creativity is supposed to work, though?
It's a better way to do it, yeah. It's a better way.
Because the thing that's fascinating to me about your career is it seems like you, fair to say, a little bit traumatized by you had some bad experiences. Dana Carvey's show sounded like a terrible experience.
Yeah,
like, you were really bummed out about that.
Yeah, I hated it.
You had other TV shows that they messed with, and you were putting out a product that you didn't like.
Yeah,
you
I also wasn't good Tang. At it yet. I also wasn't good at any of those things yet.
But still traumatized to know that they were messing with them, right?
No, I wouldn't say traumatized at all. I mean, I'm
what would be the right word?
I learned from it, you know?
All right.
I was cautioned and educated. I was educated by all those things.
Fair.
Easily the best way to describe it.
Dana Carvey show not a little traumatizing?
Yeah, but that was for personal. I mean, I went through personal trauma in that, and even then trauma. I just don't believe in trauma. That's a white guy's word.
Totally.
You know what I mean? A black guy gets, you know, loses his life. He's like, I was traumatized. No, we put these medical words on stuff that just happens in life.
Yeah, that's true.
I had a shitty run on a bunch of shows, but I've always said this, that you get more information from failure than you do success, because there's forensics, there's a dead body on the floor, and there's all kinds of information. You know, there's, you can see what, how well, clearly he should have done this, and he, you know. But when everybody wins and there's just confetti everywhere, you don't really, you know what I mean? Nobody looks into it. You don't really find out what, wins aren't analyzed in a way, for me, that are, you know.
So what made you say, I'm cutting everybody out, I'm doing this TV show myself, my way?
Because
I mean, you're even editing the show yourself.
Yeah, I edited it.
Everybody's out.
I directed it. Because I got the skill set to do it that way. I think anybody who could would. There are some people who like to just show up and do a show and get a check.
Yeah.
And they don't think about, like, I'm interested in everything. Like, when I tour and they tell me, hey, you're doing the Chicago theater, and here's how much you're making. They tell me this big, exciting number. Then I ask them, well, how much are the tickets? And then they go, well, you know, in order to pay you that, they're charging $50 a ticket. I don't want people to pay $50 a ticket to see me. How much do I get paid if they pay $30 a ticket? Well, geez, it's only this. And I'm like, well, that's more money than my dad made in his life. You know what I mean? I'll take it. And also, once I started looking at it that way, I learned stuff. Like, I learned that if you ask for a high guarantee for a live show, you drive up the ticket price because the risk is higher. But if you tell the theater, look, don't guarantee me anything. Only pay me if we make money. Then the price of the tickets come down. And they don't have to advertise as much because they're not as afraid that they're going to lose. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally.
So, and if you work at a theater without a guarantee, you actually get paid more because the show costs less. Mm-hmm. It costs less for the advertising, all that stuff. And if you sell it out, you will make more money. So I started learning about that stuff. It's really interesting to me. So when I look at the way that they release comedy videos, I thought, none of that works. Nobody's really seeing it who wants to. It's not exciting, and it gets put commercials in it, and someone else cuts it, and they don't really know how stand-up works. I really just want to shoot this show and put it on and not have to talk to anybody about it. And also, I was intrigued by the idea, if it's really cheap and easy, will that motivate people that really want to see it? And the worst thing that could have happened was everybody steals it, and it's out there.
Yeah.
And I get on with my life. I mean, the money I paid to produce it was taken out of the tickets of the people who came to see those shows that when I shot for the special. So,
with the show, it seems like you lucked out with John Landgraf. Is it Landgraf?
John Landgraf, yeah.
At some point, well, you need...
You're talking about the TV show.
Well, no, no, you moved it to the comedy thing, but I had one more question about the TV show.
Yeah.
It seemed like you lucked out with that guy, because at some point you need to luck out with one guy, yeah. right? Who yeah. can just be like, no, leave this guy alone.
Yeah,
we're going to trust him. We're going to give him money. He's going to pull it off.
That makes a huge difference, yeah. He was the... Yeah. When I met him, I realized this guy's... I'll do whatever this guy says. And he also told me everything about how he pays the bills. Like, he explained it all to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, he said, look, if you can do the show for this cheap, then you can do anything you want, because this is an amount of money I can just write this check at my desk. And no one's going to notice. Like, he wasn't risking enough money. The thing is, artists can be very greedy, and they want to get paid a lot, and then they're amazed at their scrutiny that comes with that money. I mean, that's just stupid.
Yeah.
If somebody's paying you $20 million to be funny for half an hour, they're going to want to look after it. They're going to want to have to look after that money.
Right.
There's nobody who has $20 million who's funny or who gets anything. So you're going to have to explain funny to an unfunny person if you want a lot of money. Folks that can write checks for $200,000, they get comedy. Like, those are funny people. John Landgraf really gets what funny is. He's a brilliant guy. I learn from him all the time.
So,
he's the only one I have to talk to.
You know, if you look at, like, what's worked with television, it seems like, for the most part, it's always one guy or two guys who's putting the show together. Like, Sopranos,
yeah,
one guy.
Voice.
Mad
yeah,
Men.
Totally.
Well, then why don't they do it that way? Why is television so afraid to just do that and just give people the autonomy over these projects?
It's a good question. I don't know. I think that... You know, because it's counterintuitive to everything else. Like, we're gonna try to make a lot of money, and this is them, and we're gonna try to make sure everybody, a lot of people like this show, and so we got to really work hard on it all to get. Like, we all have to make every decision very carefully. We have to pick, what do people like? They like nice looking people, and then they crowd together a bunch of unfunny, nice looking people. And they take a script that's just been worked over by so many people that nobody remembers what it was about anymore.
Yeah.
And people watch it and they go, this is dog shit. I hate this. This isn't interesting. Or they go, okay, I'll watch it if you make me. It's on the buses and everything. Like, people seem to watch
Airplane.
Some TV shows just because they're like, it's like a national duty to watch some of these shows.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you take a show and you just take a guy and you go make it, and the guy's willing to work for not $1 trillion a minute, you get something interesting. One person's voice or two people's voices is just more interesting. And it's interesting to watch what people do right and what they do wrong. You know, as long as it's one guy, like, what's that guy going to do next? That's what is compelling to people. It isn't, I love that guy. That guy always does the right thing. That guy's so handsome. That guy gets all the chicks. That's not what makes people watch something, is what is that guy gonna, I wonder what he's going to do. That's what makes people watch stuff, is curiosity. That's why reality is so big, because they're like, what are these nutty people going to do? I don't know. I don't know what to expect.
From the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
Yeah, exactly. So good fiction works that way, too, that it makes people wonder what's going to happen. But when you have notes meetings with executives, they ask all those questions at the meeting, and they want you to answer them on the screen. They go, I don't understand why that's happening. Can you explain it? No, because then nobody will watch it.
Right.
If there was a network... note session for The Wizard of Oz, they would have said, can we just tell her when she first gets there that all she has to do is click her heels? Can you just explain? Because that's really confusing to me.
Yeah.
And then then it would have been Dorothy. This would be a now version of Wizard of Oz. Dorothy gets to Oz and says, I don't know how to get home. And she says, well, all you have to do is click your heels and say there's no place like home. And then she goes, oh, well, maybe I'll hang around for a while. And then you just watch her hang around with no... You know, no.
Can you imagine, like, Cheers? Why does it have to be in a bar?
Yeah.
I like what you have, but I don't know, the bar, the drinking, we have sponsors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now all of a sudden it's in a video store.
Yeah, well, they like the bar because that's cheap. Whenever it's one location, that's great.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah, that's why Happy Days was always at Arnold's or what's his name's house?
Big Al's, whatever the...
Arnold's, yeah. That's why you had to jump it. You had to do all this stuff in there.
What made you decide on the structure, which is not a structure? For the show.
Well, that's how the pilot went. Like, I just ended up, I wrote a scene where I'm on a date with a girl, and I wrote like three or four scenes, and then I thought, that's about all I want to watch of that. I don't want to watch her then go, you know what, you're kind of a nice guy, or me going, you know, I just wanted to see 10 minutes of it. And I thought, that's enough of that.
Yeah.
And then I wrote this thing of this story that happened to me and my kids on a bus, and I wrote that, and that seemed short, and I thought, that's all also. A regular show, you'd go like, well, okay, to make it half an hour, I got to have me and the teacher kind of connect and have something meaningful happen. I thought, I don't, as soon as it got uninteresting, I just stopped writing. And so then I had a couple pieces, and then I thought, yeah, so maybe the show has a couple stories in it. Sometimes. And then what do I do between? Do I talk to the camera? I can't. I don't like talking to camera. So I thought, why don't I just do stand-up? Just do stand-up. So I just called it together. And I got some music that I really liked. I got some guys to play jazz music for me in a studio. And made it like a movie. Like a couple of short movies with some stand-up. And then other times I made a whole story that was all one thing. It didn't. Nobody's expecting me to do the show in any particular way. So I just keep changing.
It's kind of liberating.
Yeah, it's great. I don't have anything I have to do. I don't have anybody that has to be on the show. Like, a cast for a TV show is a nightmare because you pick five people and you go, I hope they're all funny forever. Like, yeah. I hope every one of them is good. And then a lot of shows you watch and there's, like, a scene between two characters and there's no reason for the scene except that they had to do something because they're on the show. But on my show, it's like, I'll put a guy on the show and if he's interesting, he'll stay. And if he's not, or if I'm not interested in using him, he'll go. That way it's like playing your way on the team. And as long as you're good, you have to fight for your place there.
Right.
If somebody else comes up that's interesting, then screw that guy. Use this
it's
guy.
Basically just your daughters and Pamela, right? Are the only...
Yeah, they're the only regulars, really.
I
had Bobby Kelly, a really funny comic from Boston. He was my brother for one season.
Yeah.
And the second season, I just didn't think of any stories, so he's gone. And I added two sisters. They're probably gone now. I've had two different mother characters on the show. I just do whatever I'm interested in for each episode.
And it could just keep going for... I mean, at that point, it could keep going for years and years and years.
I don't know.
Like.
I don't know, yeah.
Or until you get tired of the character.
Well, I love... Yeah, the characters, yeah. I don't know. I love doing the show. I love doing that work, so I hope I keep coming up with stuff.
Did it scare you that when it became, like, super cool to like the show?
Did it scare me?
Yeah.
No, it didn't. It's weird. There's like a weird vertigo to getting like sort of bigger than I'm used to being. That's weird. Because I've been doing this for 25 years now.
Yeah.
So I've been working on it for years without anyone caring, and which has been fine with me.
Right.
And so now doing the same thing I've been doing all this time, but having notoriety and some fame, it's weird. Yeah, it gives you a funny feeling in your belly. A little bit. It's something to get used to. It can be stressful, you know, because it's like, it's just, you know, I'd rather not be on the top of a high building. I'd rather
right.
just be walking down the street.
Well, because at some point there's a little bit of a backlash. Season three starts.
Season three
like, oh,
might be the season.
Not as good as season two. And then they start
two.
That. And
I'm sure, I thought that would happen for season two. I assumed it would.
Yeah. Well, season two, I think, because it felt so different than season one, it just kind of went... I don't know. It was, I don't want to say more serious, maybe more intense.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Like there were some episodes where it was like there's 10 minutes where it was definitely wasn't.
No funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That happened.
But yet we're so attached to the character. You're just kind of locked in, which is a really cool place to be. That's what I loved about Cheers. Like, Cheers is still probably my favorite, network sitcom.
Yeah, that was good.
Cheers would go dark sometimes, and Cheers would be about the characters, and they didn't have to do set up, punchline. So, you know, it was a real show.
Well, I don't really like comedy, you know. I don't like stuff that's comedy, because it's like you're expecting to laugh, and you're watching the pattern of the humor, and you're waiting for the next joke. That's
beat,
not...
Beat, beat.
Yeah, the things that really make you laugh in life are stuff that just kicks you in the balls out of nowhere. Like, you're just in life, and then something happens, and you go, oh, my God, and you laugh really hard?
Yeah.
That's really funny when that happens. And the things that have made me laugh the hardest in TV and movies have never been comedies. You know, like Goodfellas or Raging Bull to me. I've laughed harder during Raging Bull than any comedy.
By the Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
I think I've laughed harder than that than... Everything but like eight comedies.
Nobody does says jokes out loud from like the Blues Brothers or whatever, you know, Dumb and Dumber. These are all funny movies, but people say put the lotion in the basket.
Yeah.
Constantly. It's still a whole thing.
I remember this was pre-internet, and my buddy Jeff and I, we just did 6 years of put the lotion in the basket stuff. And then the internet started, and you could start seeing it, and people talking about it, like, other people know about this? We thought it was like our thing.
No, it's
I was
huge.
Disappointed.
People, that stuff is funny. So when you're, I like to make the show that you don't know. It's also boring to watch a drama where it's like, here's the next dramatic thing. And boy, do these people ever laugh? Do these people ever have a good time? Like in a drama, it's just like, who lives like this? And it's the same in a comedy.
Yeah.
Who talks like this and then makes another remark like this, like every 10 seconds? It's, to me, it gives me a headache to watch that, where every single thing that's being said is a joke. It's just not, I can't take it in.
Well,
but
now,
if you're just showing people, and sometimes their life is scary, sometimes it's dramatic, sometimes it's funny, sometimes it's strange, then you get to fire all those cylinders. They all work, you know?
Well, do you feel like Curb Enthusiasm, like all these cable shows, you can stretch the boundaries a little bit and take some chances. You don't have to stick to that formula.
Yeah.
In a way, it's been even worse for the network shows than it already was, because now they really look like... predictable and terrible, because look at what's going on over here.
Yes, because there's all kinds of options now. Yeah. It used to be that NBC, CBS, and ABC were, that's what you got to watch. So whatever those guys decided to put on the air, that's what everybody watched. And now you don't have to watch them. So I don't know why they're still doing what they're doing.
I don't. Maybe they won't. There might be a point when they don't.
I don't know.
It might just be reality shows and people get hit in the
nuts. That's mostly what they do. So I don't know. I think it's hard for them to adapt. They are not adaptable folks. The other thing, too, is that a lot of people still watch those networks, like more people than watch where I am. And that's a good thing. I wouldn't want any more audience than I have, I don't think. I think if it gets too much broader... I'll upset people.
So. Well, you talked about the timing thing. Like 10 years ago, maybe the show doesn't get a chance.
Oh,
but now the rating is at a point where they can take a chance.
Yeah, and also I'm spending little enough of their money that it's worth it.
Yeah.
Like they can pay for my show with advertisers that don't even know what the show is. There's the Magic Mops or whatever they're selling, or Roger Daltrey's 60s music CD collection or whatever, these things. That's who's,
The LA Porn Convention.
Yeah,
you'll get like a lot of local cable access.
It's not Jeep Grand Cherokee presents Louis. That's not going to happen. Tiger Woods can't even sell Buicks just because he somebody. That's how serious people are about that kind of thing. But they told me they were going to move my show to 10 o'clock after the first season.
Ooh.
And then they went to advertisers who buy 10 o'clock, and they were all like, they literally said to them, this is a joke, right? Like, they watched the show, they're like, this is like a prank, like a funny corporate prank. Like, they wouldn't believe that anyone would ever. So 10:30, they told me they'll just stay there. And I'm happy there. I don't want more. No, I don't want to upset
anybody.
I'm sure
you get a lot of DVR, you get a lot of iTunes.
Yeah, plenty of people watch it.
Yeah, the time slot doesn't ultimately even matter, probably.
No, and I wouldn't want to get paid more, and I wouldn't want more people watching. I'm in a perfect zone, and I'm collecting. I think I'm getting more people to the show.
Yeah.
Slowly. If you just put everything out there and say, everybody's going to like this, there's going to be so much ill will, because most people aren't going to like it. But if you just kind of chuck it on and go, if anybody's interested, we're doing this. And then people start gathering.
Well, I know it's not why you did it, but it seemed like the Dane Cook episode became like kind of that internet, holy shit, did you see this? Like, and it just, I got forwarded so many times. And it just seemed like that kind of hit the zeitgeist there for a couple of days. And maybe that helped the show too, I'm guessing.
Oh, definitely. The Dane thing was great. We have a bunch of things like that. Like, I did think consciously about how the show is in a world where people watch stuff and they go, holy shit, and then they virally watch it. And it gets posted on Huffington Post or whatever, all these things. So the first season, I always made YouTube clips. Every episode, I would make a YouTube clip of what I thought would be the really talkable scene.
Yeah.
Like the second episode of the show,
it was the poker scene, right?
Yeah. That was the first one that before this episode was done airing, I got it up on YouTube right away because I knew the folks would be intrigued by that and want to talk about it. And the next day, it's all over all kinds of sites, and they have my YouTube clip to go to as a reference. They have, look at this. This is what happened. Here's what I think about it. And so it was fun with the show to go, like, let's do stuff that intrigues folks that way. And also because the show was in capsules and it's in pieces, I could do something like that. The poker scene, nobody in that scene is in any more scenes of that episode. It's just one scene.
Yeah.
And there it was. People saw it. And that thing never stops coming back to me, that poker scene. It really...
Really?
Yeah, it just always keeps regenerating. And then second season, though, I didn't do it as much just because I was tired. I didn't have time.
You're editing the thing, for God's sakes.
Yeah, because it had to go on my site because FX's YouTube channel... it has like 300 followers, and if you put something on there, it gets seen like 100 times a year, like literally that low.
Yeah.
When I have like 60,000 YouTube subscribers, so when I put something on, it invariably gets at least like 250,000 hits.
Right.
Because people like a guy's YouTube. They don't like... This is another thing that led me to do the special that way. Nobody wants Comedy Central or FX to tell them what to watch.
Yeah.
But if I throw something up, or anybody who's just, if you had a YouTube that you make, people will go, "Well, what do you do?" And they'll want to see it.
Right.
So, yeah, the Dane thing, I like the idea of that kind of stuff where the scene's a little scene that you sit and you watch.
7 minutes, perfect
thing.
Perfect YouTube size.
Yeah. I don't remember thinking that would happen, but yeah, that was... that was something, because of everything that had happened with Dane and how long all that shit had gone on, I thought if I get him and me in a room... And we have this out in a way that feels really private and really real. It's really... There's some people who are going to really love it. Like, I knew it would be great.
Would it become like one of the, you know, in the whole comedy world, that was like one of the four or five things that people always talked about.
Yeah.
And it was kind of settled.
Yeah, it was
on that show.
Yeah, exactly.
I know you were probably tired of talking about it.
I was really tired. I mean, I used to get every interview I did until I got my show.
Yeah.
Every interview I did, people asked me, what's up with Dane Cook thing, and I would just...
What would happen, like, when you cross paths with him?
I only saw him one time when we did Comic Relief. We were both on Comic Relief, like, that year that it was going on.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember I was sitting on a couch in the green room watching the TV, and he was sitting next to me. And we're both watching the TV and not looking at each other.
Really?
And it felt stupid.
Yeah.
And he has friends that I have. So it was like...
Well, like that Bobby Kelly's
one of my best friends, and he's one of Dane's best friends.
That's weird.
And Gary Gulman. And Gary and Bobby were both there. And so Dane would go over and talk to Gary and Bobby, and then I would wait for him to leave, and then I'd go over. It was just stupid. It's like, what are we, kids? And so we're sitting on the couch, and I was like, I'm not doing this. And I turned to him, and I go, hey, great. He had been on stage, and he did a good job.
Yeah.
I said, hey, great set. And he said, thank you. Thanks a lot. I'm excited to watch you go on. I said, oh, great. And that, we got it out of the way. And then we were on the... We didn't settle anything.
Yeah.
But then we were on the stage, and people are shaking hands, so we shook hands. I didn't, you know, I'm not going to have an enemy. What am, you know, am I in a schoolyard? I don't need enemies. But anyway, we never really solved anything. We wrote a couple emails back and forth, and then...
If you were rappers, it would have worked better, I think.
Yeah.
Comedian's not as good.
No, the comedian gripes are... That's one reason I never said anything about it, is because who cares?
Yeah. Well, obviously, a lot of people did care.
A lot of people really cared. And I felt bad for Dane, because I knew a lot of the backlash was backlash. It wasn't about me. Nobody was looking carefully at the thing. They were just enjoying pissing in his face. They just loved...
And it was a little like he had gotten too popular.
Mm-hmm.
You were the comics comic. You weren't popular enough.
Which neither thing is true.
Right.
Dane is not some kind of a bigger than life person. He's a human being. And I'm also not some, you know, terrific. I'm just a...
You're not a cause.
Asshole like everybody else. Yeah. So I made us both human. That was the idea. It was just to humanize us, meet us in the middle somewhere. I think it helped Dane because I think
it really helped him.
Well, I think his climb was so about him being a massive, huge figure. And I think that's never a good idea because no one is that. No one is that. You're just a person. And people don't like feeling like you're bigger than them.
They don't want to root for you either.
No.
Yeah.
So I think people see him as what he is. He's a guy. He's just a guy. And I think he, you know, was, you know, in a frenzy, and he was, you know, there's people that, like, Robin Williams has admitted that when he's got such a thirst for ideas, and his mind works like a motor.
Yeah.
And he's been in rooms and seen stuff and then absorbed it and then spat it out.
Right.
And he's admitted that. And, you know, Robin's a great comic. There's no looking at it any other way. He's a great actor. But he doesn't get vilified the way Dane did. You know what I mean? Like, there's other people who have made those mistakes. I know comedians that are really funny and well-respected who take shit from other people without knowing it. Like, I've seen people do that, and no one goes after them because aesthetically they love them. But Dane, you know,
so how'd you
buy super, you know, his hair right. is greased up and he's wearing a tight T-shirt. So people enjoyed shitting all over him.
How did
but he's
you,
a good man. He's a good person.
Well, how'd you approach him?
I wrote him an email and I said, look, I wrote a thing for my show and it has you in it and it addresses our issue.
Yeah.
And I think if you read it, you'd want to do it. I can't send it to you because I didn't want to give it to him as...
Yeah.
I can't send it to you, so I'd like you to just come to my office and read it with me. And if you don't do it, I'll get somebody to play it. Like, I just put that at the end.
Yeah, you would have got an actor?
Yes. I just decided I'm going to be a little bit of an asshole and just say, I'll get somebody else to do it. I don't need you to do it. Because then he'll really want to. At least I just wanted to get him in the room.
Yeah.
So he showed up by himself and sat in my office and we read the whole script together. Like, he read all the parts that weren't me. He read my agent, my daughters, everything. And then we got to that scene and God, I really admire him. He didn't ask to take a minute to read it by himself. You know, he didn't protect himself in any way. He just sat there with me and read what I wrote for him to say. And,
so he didn't come up with that.
No, that's all mine. I wrote
really?
All.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought maybe you ad-libbed
it. No, we didn't ad-lib anything.
Did he have trouble sticking to that?
No, he didn't. He read it. When he read it, I wrote it based on what I thought he would have said. And also, to me, every time I'm against an adversary on my show, I want to let them win. Because it's more interesting to me.
Yeah.
If I get into, like, a kind of weird territory and I write myself a winning line,
yeah,
it just feels fake, you know? But I feel like I can go to weird places as long as I don't get the best lines, you know? And it all helps me. I'm happy to lose an argument to Dane on my show because he's on my show and we're doing this really cool thing. I'm more interested in seeing the thing happen than wanting some kind of outcome that benefits me, you know, or makes me look good. So I wrote this stuff like I thought, what would he really feel? If I was him, like, what would I feel about this, you know? I know it's frustrating to him. I know he's angry about it. So where would that come from? I didn't know, and I thought about it carefully, and I thought, well, he'd probably feel like nobody really gave him a chance, and I'm getting a bullshit pass because of what people think I am, and you know, that he was just, why would he steal three jokes when he has, you know, hours and hours of material that no one thinks he's, who would do that? Why would someone do that? And so I wrote it out that way, and we read it. And his thoughts were, he said, I think that I'm too angry in this thing because I'm not angry anymore. I've let it go. Huh. And I would like this thing to reflect. I'd like to show people that I'm an even-headed guy and that I'm funny. I'd like to be funny in it more because I was taking pot shots at him.
Yeah, yeah.
He's just angry. And he wanted to be funny like me, and he wanted to be easier about it. And I said, well, I understand how you want to be perceived, but that's not interesting. I have no interest in how you're perceived.
Right.
It means nothing to me. I just want to do this scene because this is going to be really cool. And I said, if you have any concerns, don't do it. And I would never fault you for not doing it. But I can't take a single note from you. I can't do it. And he thought about it and he said, okay, I'll do it. And he did it as written. The only change that he asked for that I did was it was supposed to take place in a comedy club. And he said, it should be at Madison Square Garden because that's where I play if I'm in New York. He said, you should have to come and see me at Madison Square Garden. And here's how stupid I am. I said, no, we're going to meet at the comedy club. That's what I wrote. And he agreed.
Yeah.
And then I told a friend of mine and he said, you're so stupid because that's way funnier. If you have to go to Madison Square Garden.
You go in the bowels of MSG.
Yeah, you have to like really grovel to this guy who sold out Madison Square Garden for this thing. It's so much better. It puts you in such a terrible position. And I realized that I was being blinded by competitiveness. So here I'm telling him, no, you're going to be playing a club. And I realized, oh my God, I'm a bit of an a- Of course it should be MSG. So I wrote him and said, we're doing MSG. And
you're like, fine, I'll do the Felt Forum, but not MSG. We're going to meet middle ground.
Exactly. And then once I got there, I realized, because it was this austere place, I realized this is so funny. And I had this idea of having these security guards, which we didn't have in the script. And so we didn't have security guards, so we called this security company, the kind that sends like 8 armed guards.
Right.
They were all armed. They were all serious, like Navy SEAL type guys. And it cost a little bit of money, but it looked perfect. So.
And I would argue that was a great thing for him ultimately. Being on the show, the whole clip, everything, I think it was good for him.
I think so.
We're going to take this over to part 2 for more Louis C.K. Check it out on ESPN.com's Pod Center or iTunes.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at Pod Center at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.